This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of July 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week, a look at the broad self-defense laws in Texas.
Texas goes a little bit farther than many other jurisdictions in protecting the right to use force in self-defense.
The few healthcare options for uninsured Texans during the pandemic.
How are we going to deal with it? How are we going to pay for it? It was just abject terror.
And a bike ride to explore Austin's Black history.
It was so nice to see Austin show up.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. Austin police say homicide detectives are still investigating the shooting death of a man in downtown Austin during a Black Lives Matter protest. A Facebook Live video showed protesters marching up Congress Avenue on Saturday night. A group bunched together at the corner of 4th Street and Congress when several gunshots rang out. That video by Haram Hidberto. Austin police say the victim approached the shooter's vehicle and was carrying an AK pattern rifle. The shooter was a licensed handgun carrier. He called police after fleeing the scene and said the rifle was pointed at him, so he fired in self-defense. A witness at the scene named Julian told KUT's Moes Bouchel that the vehicle almost hit the group of protesters before the shooting. We don't know a lot about the situation. Obviously, APD homicide detectives are still trying to collect video and photo evidence. They actually issued a statement this week saying anyone who may have additional video or photo evidence, please to offer it to them. The shooter was arrested and then later released while police investigate. All of this raises the issue of the broad self-defense laws in Texas. KUT's Trey Schar spoke about this with University of Texas Professor of Criminal Law, Jennifer Lauren.
In Texas, as elsewhere, actually, self-defense basically has two components. An individual to assert self-defense has to have actually believed that it was immediately necessary to use deadly force in order to prevent the use of deadly force or a serious violent crime against themselves. And secondly, they also have to have had a reasonable belief in that regard. In that respect, as I said, Texas law is like the law of virtually every other jurisdiction. It's also the case, though, that Texas goes a little bit farther than some other jurisdictions, and in some cases, many other jurisdictions, in protecting the right to use force in self-defense. For one, Texas does not require that an individual retreat to safety, even if they could, before using otherwise justified defensive force. This is sometimes called stand your ground. And Texas, along with a slight majority, actually, of jurisdictions across the United States, have this stand your ground provision of self-defense law. Additionally, though, Texas goes beyond a number of other jurisdictions in terms of protecting the right to use force in defense, not only of oneself, but also of property. And also in creating certain presumptions that allow a defendant a little bit more evidentiary leeway in making the case that their belief in the need to use force was in fact reasonable.
So how did these laws become so broad?
Well, it's interesting. In Texas, they started narrower than they are. So Texas did a sort of comprehensive reform of its penal code in 1973. The legislature enacted a self-defense provision that did not have the stand your ground provision in it. In fact, it did require a defendant who wanted to assert self-defense to establish that it was not safe for them to retreat before using it. That duty to retreat got narrowed by the legislature in 1995 first, when they adopted something known as the Castle Doctrine. It basically said, well, you usually have to retreat if you're in your home, if you're in your castle, on your property. You don't have to retreat under those circumstances. Then about 12 years later, the legislature again broadened the protection of self-defense and removed any duty to retreat anywhere. So the answer to sort of how the law of self-defense became as broad as it did in Texas is it was a matter of legislative choice in the amendments to the statute that sets out the elements of self-defense.
Well, under Texas law, if someone provokes a conflict, do they still have the right to use deadly force to defend themselves in that circumstance?
No, they don't. So what will amount to something that the law would consider to be provocation is obviously very fact dependent. But an individual who essentially brings about a reaction from someone else that then endangers them loses the right to assert self-defense. Again, as you said, that's the doctrine known as provocation. An individual essentially can't have provoked the conflict or the altercation that leads to them having the need to protect themselves.
And if someone is released after a shooting like the one which occurred Saturday night, is that an indication that police think it was a self-defense shooting, or could the person be charged and arrested later?
Well, particularly at such an early stage of the investigation, I think it would be a mistake to read anything conclusive into a decision to release an individual. For starters, police have to have probable cause before they can arrest an individual for a crime. And if they have some affirmative evidence concerning self-defense, that's going to start to go into a kind of total mix of factors about probable cause. But if they're still investigating the case, that means that they may develop a sort of, you know, evolving view of whether they have enough facts to ultimately arrest. But furthermore, police aren't obligated to arrest immediately upon probable cause existing. In other words, they may, for any number of reasons, make decisions about the timing of when to announce a final view of the case or to make an arrest. So you really can't read anything into a conclusion about what the police currently believe simply by a decision not to arrest. And a decision not to arrest now certainly doesn't foreclose the police from making a decision to arrest down the road.
Professor Jennifer Lauren, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Pleasure to do it.
The Austin Police Department has released video recordings of the fatal shooting of a Black and Hispanic man in April. That man's name, Mike Ramos, has been invoked during protests of police violence and at council meetings where people have called to defund the police. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has more.
Austin Police Officer Christopher Taylor shot Ramos as he drove out of a parking spot in Southeast Austin. Police had shown up after someone called 911, claiming a man had a gun. In body and dashboard camera video released today, Ramos gets out of the car, puts his hands up, and lifts his shirt, following police orders. When officers tell Ramos to walk toward them, he does not. He yells he doesn't have a gun. He tells police not to shoot and that they're scaring him. Scott Hendler is a lawyer representing Ramos's family. He says officers escalated rather than de-escalated the situation.
By barking commands and threat at a obviously confused and potentially under the influence Michael Ramos.
In a report to the Attorney General's office, the police department argued that Ramos was using his car as a weapon. At the end of the video, Ramos can be seen driving away from police when Officer Taylor fires three shots, killing him. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Austin is moving toward renaming public spaces that honor white supremacy or the Confederacy. As KUT's Andrew Weber tells us, a city council vote this week sets up the framework for the renaming process.
Starting in September, the city will begin identifying streets, parks, creeks, anything really, that honors white supremacy or the Confederacy and consider changing their names. The measure requires city staff to present 5 to 10 possibilities every 6 months. Then there will be an education and public input process, as well as a process to suggest alternate names. Then city council could okay changing a name. Councilmember Natasha Harper Madison, who authored the resolution, says it's not a silver bullet, but she called it a step in the right direction.
It would be the height of hypocrisy to say Black Lives Matter while not addressing the elephant in our streets, Confederate Avenue, Plantation Road, and Dixie Drive. These existing street names have no place in the city of Austin.
The city's equity office outlined those streets and dozens more landmarks to rename in a report 2 years ago. Suggestions included Lamar Boulevard, Pease Park, and even Austin itself. You can read more about that at KUT.org. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
In Texas, COVID-19 cases have been skyrocketing. And there's another thing that's been surging as well. Texans without health insurance. A lot of people lost jobs that had health plans attached to them. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the state has not set up any healthcare coverage options for many of those people.
Steve Alvarez is a Tejano musician who lives in the San Antonio area. In late June, he started feeling sick. It started out mild, but then he had fever, chills, shortness of breath. Alvarez thought it was a cold he just couldn't shake off.
I had a couple of good days. I felt like I'd backtrack, and I was just really run down. This thing lingered and lingered.
Alvarez eventually got a free coronavirus test from the city. It was positive. Alvarez and his wife, who also got infected, never ended up in the hospital. But he says there were some scary days there.
We thought if this starts getting much worse, we need to start thinking about how we're going to deal with it, how we're going to pay for it. It was just abject terror as to what was going to happen.
He lost his health insurance a year ago when he was laid off from his day job in construction safety. So while he was sick, he paid for everything, remote doctor visits, some prescriptions and over-the-counter medication, all out of pocket.
If there's something that's not generic, that's just absolutely too expensive, I have to consider doing without it.
The pandemic has driven the uninsured rate even higher in Texas. Now, among Texas adults under 65, 29% don't have health insurance. Elena Marks is with the Episcopal Health Foundation in Houston.
Texans who lose their health insurance that is tied to jobs simply have fewer options for new insurance because we do not have Medicaid expansion.
Texas officials have refused to expand Medicaid, despite having the highest uninsured rate in the country for years. Mark says the pandemic has raised the stakes.
Everything that's happening now was happening before. It's just on a path of acceleration because there are so many more people who are sick and who are getting very sick, and the costs are really expensive.
And this hurts patients. Stacey Pogue is with Every Texan, a policy think tank in Austin. She says some uninsured people have found free testing, but others have had to pay hundreds of dollars they can't afford.
We need to do everything we can to make sure people in our community aren't afraid to get tested because of cost or aren't afraid to get treatment because of cost.
And when uninsured Texans do need care, it's the hospitals that often have to pick up the cost. John Hawkins is with the Texas Hospital Association. He says even before the pandemic, the price for Texas hospitals to treat the uninsured was more than $7 billion a year.
We've been able to make it work, frankly, because of the growth in the state. But as we look at COVID going forward, it really does make the case that we have to look at addressing the coverage piece.
Hawkins says there's some federal relief money coming in soon, but he says in the long term, this could lead to service cuts and hospital closures. And in the short term, uninsured Texans like Steve Alvarez are feeling squeezed. Alvarez says they're doing everything they can to not lose their house.
But that bottom's going to fall out soon enough, and that's what I'm really dreading right now.
Advocates say Texas lawmakers will have to start seriously considering expanding healthcare coverage to more Texans, maybe even Medicaid. And they plan to make it a political issue for Texas Republicans in November. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
The Austin City Council is lifting a prohibition on public drinking that exists in some parts of East Austin. As late as 2009, the City Council had been expanding areas on the east side where it's against city rules to drink alcohol on streets and sidewalks. District 1 City Council member Natasha Harper Madison sponsored the resolution. Before the vote, she pointed out that it does not change rules on public intoxication.
What it does, though, is end a double standard for east side residents who haven't had access to the same rights as most of their mostly white and wealthier neighbors on the other side of the highway.
The vote does leave in place other central city zones where public drinking is prohibited. That includes most of downtown Austin and blocks east of South Lamar Boulevard and bordering Guadalupe. A recent study found that college towns across the country are potentially confronting major losses in population and revenue if students don't return to campus because of the coronavirus. One of the most at-risk towns, San Marcos. KUT's Rianne Roldan reports.
The city is home to Texas State University and ranked as the 9th most economically vulnerable in a study that compared 95 college towns with populations of 50,000 or more. Mark LaCastro is with Smart Asset, the financial technology company that conducted the study.
This area is really dependent on the local student body for spending. Even in places where schools may resume in-person classes in the fall, local businesses that typically rely on spending from the student body, they still may suffer a little bit.
In 2018, students in San Marcos made up about 41% of the population. In the study, the city had the 4th highest student population relative to the city's population. Rhianne Roldan, KUT News.
The University of Texas is just 5 weeks away from its first scheduled football game at DKR Texas Memorial Stadium. The university is considering allowing stands to fill to 25% capacity, but as KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, Austin's interim health authority does not think that will stop the spread of the virus at games.
Dr. Mark Escott weighed in on UT's revised plan of allowing just 25% of the 100,000-seat-plus stadium. In a tweet, Escott said, if infection rates hold at 0.4%, that means 100 people would be at the game with the virus, and he said the spread would start from there. Though UT is within Travis County, decisions on football games on state land are up to the governor, Board of Regents, the UT administration, and, of course, the Big 12 Conference. Social distancing at games is going to be an issue as football season approaches. The Dallas Cowboys sent a message to fans that they would not be able to honor any season ticket holders this season because of NFL distancing and safety protocols, which will limit the number of people at games.
That's KUT's Jimmy Moss. Earlier this year, we put out a call for your stories about overcoming differences. True stories about finding common ground. Working with the Austin Public Library and the Library Foundation, we collected the submissions and helped writers shape their stories into pieces to read for the radio. So right now, we're going to hear from a story from Eileen Haddad. She thought there was a difference to overcome until she was shown there wasn't.
Growing up, I didn't know much about Arab culture. Mrs. Shapiro never mentioned anything about it in Hebrew school. We stuck mainly to the classics. Noah, Moses, Lot. The most I ever learned was when I traveled to Israel with my synagogue's youth group during my senior year of high school. We spent a week on a military base, living life like local teens. Rather than figuring out how to decorate their dorm rooms, Israeli high school graduates were preparing to go into mandatory military service. My traveling companions and I were told that all the lights surrounding us were Arab villages. We were so scared. I never knew an Arab person until I met my future husband, Bill. He wasn't very scary at all. At first, I didn't even realize he was of Syrian descent, despite his last name. When I discovered his background, I thought my family would disapprove, so I hid it from them for a long time. But their knowledge of last names was stronger than mine, so they figured it out before I did. I was going to be a Jewish girl in the middle of an Arab-American family. Although Bill and I weren't married at the time, I was worried I'd have to negotiate 3,000 years of disagreements should we ever decide to take the plunge. But that's not how it played out. The turning point in our relationship was when Bill's grandmother, Situ in Arabic, came for a visit. I prepared a big spaghetti dinner for her, the only dish I knew how to make. Before we sat down at the table, Situ insisted on braiding my hair. Her own gray hair was worn tucked up into a bun. I never liked my hair pulled back. I was uncomfortable with my face so exposed, but I let her do it anyway. With the smell of spaghetti sauce in the air, I knelt on the floor in front of her, her hands, gnarled and time-worn, braided as if it were second nature. It was. Those same hands, used to make round Syrian bread and check the heat of pots of food for nearly 90 years, had become calloused into flesh oven mitts. After she was done braiding, Situ had me stand up so she could pronounce, "Now you are Arab too." We all had a good laugh. She then turned me around to look directly into my eyes and said, "It doesn't matter. In the end, We are alike. And that's how she treated me the rest of her life. Such a simple act created a bond. Years later, Bill would confess it was when Situ braided my hair that he knew he wanted to marry me. Now I test our food with hands more delicate than Situ's, but I'm on my way to making flesh oven mitts of my own. After all, in the end, we are alike.
That was Eileen Haddad reading her story for our Common Ground Project. We're going to be hearing more of these in the weeks ahead. Amid the calls for racial justice happening all around us, a lot of people have felt compelled to do something, whether it be having uncomfortable conversations with family members or making their way into the streets to protest. KUT's Nadia Hamdan reports on one man in Austin who felt the need to do something within his community.
It's around 10 a.m. on a scorching hot Sunday morning in June, and Talib Abdullahi is standing in front of the Texas State Capitol.
We're going to abide by all traffic laws. We're not going to be rolling any red lights. We're going to be respectful of all drivers and police officers.
Talib, a 30-year-old black man, is straddling his bike, his voice echoing through a portable PA system. That's because he's addressing a crowd of people, all on bikes.
Also, make sure to watch your speed, especially when we're coming down hills. And also, please make sure to social distance as much as you can.
They all showed up for one reason, to learn about Austin's black history. Now, Talib is not a historian. He's an event coordinator for Tito's Handmade Vodka. So you may be wondering, how did he find himself on the steps of the Capitol, about to lead a tour of Austin Black history? And why are they all on bikes? It all started in early June. Talib had just returned home from the protest at Houston Tillotson, where thousands of people had rallied for an end to police violence and systemic racism.
I was thinking that night, like, man, it would be really cool to tie all this energy of everyone coming out in the streets with something that's fun, like bike riding, which I love. It's my biggest hobby of all time. And connect it with Black history.
Talib says he has a passion for both history and cycling, and he thought this would be a good way to sustain, quite literally, the momentum of the last 2 weeks.
I kind of got on Google Maps that night, and I was like, I think I could make this route go just about 8.46 miles and make it in honor of George Floyd and just kind of tie everything together.
8 minutes and 46 seconds was the amount of time a Minneapolis police officer had his knee on Floyd's neck. Floyd was a black man, and his death sparked nationwide protests against police brutality, including the ones in Austin. Talib's route stretched from west to east Austin and would feature 12 historical sites significant to black history. This includes the Texas African American History Memorial at the Capitol, the Haskell House in Clarksville, and the old Jacob Fontaine building in West Campus.
Jacob Fontaine, who's one of my favorite figures in Austin's black history, who started like the Gold Dollar Press and tried to help lift up a lot of the freed slaves and people in the African American community.
Talib figured he'd have 20 or 30 of his friends join him on the ride. So he posted the idea on his personal Instagram story the next morning.
And it just snowballed.
Within a few hours, a screenshot of his post was making its way across Instagram, then Facebook. Even some local bike shops were sharing it.
Initially, I was like, whoa, I didn't plan for that. You know, I didn't plan for it to be that big.
He didn't know how many people would actually show up, but he wanted to be prepared for more than 30. So what started as a simple bike ride with friends soon turned into a grassroots-led initiative, bringing together people from all across the community. His friends rallied behind him, and within a week, they had a whole team of volunteers. Cyclists from different clubs offered to help keep the riders safe and hydrated on the road. A coffee shop donated free cold brew. Pedicabbers promised to be there for people who were not able to ride bikes.
There was just a huge outpouring from the community, and it was, you know, really heartwarming. People willing to donate their time, and that was really beautiful, really amazing.
It was the Sunday of the ride, exactly 1 week after the protest at Houston Tillotson. The invite had specified a 10 a.m. meeting time.
But Talib arrived at the Capitol early and waited to see just how many people would actually show up. The bikes started rolling in, and they didn't stop. By the time Talib started talking, there was a sea of more than 400 mass cyclists crowding both lanes of 11th Street. It was so busy that at one point, the volunteers had to start directing them down the sides of the sidewalk so cars could pass.
This really means a lot. I put this out literally on Monday, and I was just like, yo, like, let's ride bikes and learn about Black history, and it accidentally went viral, and you guys are here now.
Donald Davis is a founding member of the Major Taylor Cycling Club of Austin. It's a group made up of majority Black cyclists. The club's namesake actually honors Major Taylor, the first Black man to win a cycling world championship in 1899. Davis was there with his fellow club members donating their time to make sure everything ran smoothly during the tour.
I just saw more and more people coming in. And when the cops blocked off the area, I was like, dude, this is going to be huge.
He says it was remarkable to see so many people from all different backgrounds come together for this ride.
It was so nice to see Austin show up. I've been here since 91. I don't think I've ever seen that kind of brotherhood and sisterhood except for like an MLK march. That's about it.
Now, Talib says he's not one for public speaking, but he felt very inspired that so many people turned out with the intention to learn.
I kind of told myself going into this that if this is the amount of attention that this specific activity is getting, then the people want it and it's something people need. So it almost like didn't matter how many people showed up. It was really just that people wanted to be there.
From the seat of his bike, Talib began telling stories about the Black experience. And when he spoke, the cyclists were quiet, save the occasional ringing of bicycle bells. 25-year-old Ximena Gamboa Bonilla was one of the riders who took the tour. She says she's often been disappointed with what she perceives as a one-sided, often whitewashed narrative associated with much of Austin's history.
At one point, it stops being lack of awareness and it starts being willingly ignorant.
But she says this ride changed something for her. The day was hot and the hills merciless, and still hundreds of people were pumping their legs and sweating their way to the next stop and the next stop and the next stop.
It was so beautiful. It made me realize, wow, there are 400 other humans here that are willing to ride in the middle of the summer. It kind of gave me more hope that in Austin, there's people that care.
The coronavirus pandemic and recent restrictions on public gatherings has kept Talib from holding another ride as big as the one in June. But he's had some small ones since then. And he's also shared the entire route online so people can take the tour themselves. But after seeing the turnout in Austin, plans are in motion to create Black History social rides in other cities like Houston, Tulsa, and Detroit.
I, if anything, would hope to be giving people tools to learn this history themselves and help people, you know, give them an opportunity to understand their own city a little bit better.
Ultimately, Talib says he just hopes to inspire more people to seek out the Black, Latinx, and Indigenous stories in their own communities.
If we can create avenues for people to do that, that's a win in my book.
Nadia Hamdan, KUT News.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice.
That's KUT Weekend for the first weekend of August 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶